Hello and welcome to the Film Basement Episode 2. I'm your host, Pete Tadone, along with Adam Corbett and Ashley Bernhardt. On this week's show, we're going to look at 1949's The Third Man, Kenneth Branagh's murder on the Orient Express. Let's go. It's showtime. You can find our little website over at lastgenpodcast.com. You can find our group, The Film Basement, over on Facebook. This show you can stream from iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music, as well as Blog Talk Radio. And as I said at the top of the show, I am joined, of course, Adam Corbett. You were with me when we kind of relaunched this and we were talking about Blade Runner. And I first wanted to, though, just say hello and welcome to Ashley Bernhardt. This is your first go-around on The Film Basement, and... you know, say hello to the people and, you know, tell them a little bit about yourself.
Hello. How's it going? Hopefully well for everyone. I am a writer, I guess. I guess I can say that. Yes, I am. I graduated from Purchase College in New York from their creative writing program. So I love screenwriting. I love movies and television. And yeah, so that's me. It's a little bit about myself. Not much else to know except for I love writing and reading and film. And TV.
We're going to learn a lot more about everyone, basically, as we kind of go through this new iteration of The Film Basement. And Adam, me and you have kind of spoken about this before. The idea behind this is that, you know, we're going to still talk about recent releases and all that kind of stuff short at the top of the show. But what we really want to do is I want to basically put films in front of you guys that hopefully you haven't seen before. And to my mind, they are what you would call classic films. Now, these all won't be like, you know, by definition, like a classic film. It might be a film that I just really dig. And I want to put it in front of you, and I want you guys to tell me whether or not, you know, what's your impression of it? Did you dig it? Do you not dig it? You know, what's the different things that you took away from it? And then in turn, we're going to be taking requests from people who listen to the show about other films that hopefully none of us have seen, or maybe only one of us, or something like that. And from that, we're basically going to just build our own kind of film basement that just says something about each and every one of us. So, you know, I know that we opened up episode one. We talked about Blade Runner. And this week we saw a couple of – we saw a recent release just a couple of nights ago that has gotten, I would say, a very, very mixed reaction from a lot of folks when you look at the reviews and you look at the returns, because I think Daddy's Home – beat it out this weekend in the box office, despite Daddy's Home getting awful reviews. Murder on the Orient Express is Kenneth Branagh, you know, directing and starring in as, you know, Hercule Poirot. And it has a massive cast of people, you know, top to bottom, left and right. But there has not been an overtly, you know, welcoming vibe to this film, it seems, from a lot of people. But you know, everyone's got an opinion. So you saw it just this morning, right?
Yes.
So what did you think? I mean, we're not going to get into plot details or anything, obviously, because the whole point of, you know, the film is that it is a mystery. But what did you think of the film?
I really enjoyed it. I think it had a wonderful time period. The cast, oh my God, the cast was great. There were so many, you know, 6 degrees from all the actors that were in the film. You know, this guy worked with this person and such and so forth. And it was great. I love anything Kenneth Branagh. I'm a big fan ever since way back then. I mean, Hamlet, his Hamlet, I thought was long, but it was like very faithful telling of Shakespeare's story. And, you know, of course he did the first Thor, which I really enjoyed, but, this is my first time really kind of like, okay, I'm going to go see a Kenneth Branagh film, you know, just go to the theater, see a Kenneth Branagh film. And I thought it was beautiful. It's beautifully shot. And just everybody, I enjoyed everybody's performance, really.
So, Adam, you know, you talked about you liked the look of the film, you know, all that. But what did you think of the overabundance in the CG, like in the environments, in the landscape? Did you find that distracting at all?
No. And the reason I am going to say that is probably because of the quality of the theater I was in. I was commenting to my girlfriend Julia that the theater we were watching it in is very muted as far as the colors go. So okay. I think when that happens, the CGI doesn't stand out nearly as much as, say, a digital projection or IMAX viewing would. So for me, it didn't stand out. So I think that probably had something to do with it.
Okay. Well, I mean, I went to a theater that I trust as much as I would trust any movie theater that's in Florida. And it did kind of stick out to me, but I don't know. It really didn't bother me because it felt very picturesque in a lot of ways, like I was looking at a painting. So I can see how that would drag some people out of it, though. But for me personally, it was never really a problem. You know, towards the storytelling itself, I thought it was – I enjoyed it, you know, quite a bit. It wasn't very – the only thing I would say is that I thought was a negative was, are there actual clues to the final answer of the riddle? Because if there aren't, that's something that, like, the classic movie Murder by Death, you know, made fun of. You know, the fact of like, oh, you introduce characters on the last page that wouldn't have given the reader a chance to solve it on their own. And I kind of feel this movie does that a little bit. Like, so I still enjoyed it because I enjoyed the method and everything going to it. But I absolutely felt that they sort of cheated and not really giving you anything to work on.
Yeah, there was a very jarring scene. I don't know if you caught it before. I'm just going to say Daisy Ridley's character and Kenneth Branagh were having a conversation, and that whole scene happened, and then they switched to the tunnel where they're all sitting. That was a very jarring edit.
Yeah, it was. The movie went from, you know, kind of like 0 to 1,000,
yes,
and then brought it back down to like the 0.
Right.
So, yeah, like that whole sort of reveal that they work into the film, I felt it was very, very rough shot. It was the only time in the movie that I was like, whoa, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Even with that moment, though, sort of pulling me out of everything, I thought that the ensemble cast, which sometimes, you know, you can get great actors, but they sort of get lost in the shuffle. I felt that that was the best part of the film, was the ensemble cast. Everyone seemed that they cared about their characters. The thing is, though, we as the audience, I don't think that we got enough information about their characters. We got the definition that you would get like in the beginning of a Shakespeare play. You know what I mean? Like, you know, Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark. And that's like it, you know. But the play is what gives you the rest of the ideas and the rest of the themes and the motivations. Where in this film, I feel that they didn't bother going into that to keep the runtime short and to keep it snappy, which it definitely feels snappy. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, learning everything in the last 3 minutes, I still enjoyed the film a lot, but I did not like that method of holding so much information back. And then at the end, like, oh, but what about this? And you're like, well, shit, if I had a shadow of an idea of that, maybe I would have been able to put a little more, you know, of my own thought into it. So did you have, you know, did, I don't know, what was your reaction to that? Or did you even notice that? Or, you know, did you see shit that I didn't? You know, there's a good possibility there was tons of stuff there and I missed it.
No, I agree. I think at least 4 or 5 of the quote unquote passengers were very underwritten, and they just sort of pop in as, hey, I'm revealed to be this connection. Bye. I'll see ya.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it felt for at least 4 or 5 of the main cast.
Yeah.
So
what, I mean, they hint towards the next film with the Poirot character. I really hope that they do it, but I also sort of hope that maybe someone else directs it, even though I love Branagh's camera work. And obviously he's incredibly good at directing actors. You know, you can see that in Thor, you know, especially like a very, you know, a nice recent example of films where acting can kind of go be, I wouldn't say the main focus of some of the films, you know, that are like just the action Marvel comic films, even though right. They've been really well acted. But Thor felt just a step above when they were doing, you know, the Asgard stuff. And over here, you see, a massive cast of some newer faces, some classic faces, they all meld really well. So I like that aspect of it, but I wonder if him being behind the camera is a little distracting to the smaller details, but he's done it before effectively in his career. So I hope they get another one. I hope that this makes enough return that he gets another shot at it, because I really enjoyed it. Like, despite my issues with it, I really had a good time with it. It's just that the reveal doesn't work. And if the reveal doesn't work in a mystery film, then you botch something in the middle, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you do have 12, 13 characters that you're supposed to be following consistently throughout the movie. You're going to lose track of a few. And I'm not sure what another director could have done, but I think the reveal kind of brings it together in some ways, but you still need that backstory, and you need that, you know, a little bit more than, you know, hey, how are you? You know, we'll see you in about 45 minutes.
Maybe you just need another 15 minutes of runtime, honestly. I wouldn't have minded it. I mean, what is it clock in at now? It clocks in at
1 hour and 54 minutes.
A 2 hour and 10 minute film, I don't think it's a problem for people.
No.
I think that's fine.
And I would have gone for that.
That would have given you a whole lot more background and a whole lot more build up into getting you to really wonder who did it. I wish I could go into a little more. The murder itself, you see things that you're like, I wonder what that is. I wonder what that is. And it's never brought up until the very, very end. You know, it's never really like dived into. So I really hope they get another one, but we will see, as film business is crazy. So who the hell knows what will happen in the future. Ashley, I want to kind of pivot over to you. When we were just getting ready to start the show up, you were telling me that you were watching some films for the very first time.
Yes. Indiana Jones, actually. I do remember seeing the fourth one. I guess it's the Crystal Skull.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Yeah, Kingdom in the theaters Crystal Skulls, when I was, I don't know, 14 or 15, whenever it came out. So I went back and I'm like, all right, let's watch these Indiana Jones, because they're on Amazon now for Prime. And I was like, all right, let's watch them. So I watched the first one very recently, and I loved it. So much fun. I think it's been a while since I've had that much fun with a movie.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, not besides like Thor, but the most recent Ragnarok.
That's a lot of
fun. Yeah. But it was a very fun adventure movie. The second one, Temple of Doom, disappointed me a little bit, because I felt like it, you know, the first one was so great that the second one, Temple of Doom, was a little bit disappointing.
What is it about? That's not a rare reaction to Temple of Doom. And I kind of love Temple of Doom. But what is it about Temple of Doom that throws people off so much? Like, when you watched it, you know, did you feel like it went a little too dark, or that it just didn't have the same amount of humor? I mean, I know one big reason why a lot of people don't like the movie, but I don't want to say it unless you say it.
Actually, the humor bothered me in this one, because the main female actor, just she annoyed the crap out of me. She didn't really, like, I don't even think she had any redeeming qualities by the end of it either. So that, Bob, the humor was not funny to me, because I'm just annoyed. I think I told Ryan, my boyfriend who I was watching it with, that I've never been so annoyed by a character in the first like 20 seconds of her on screen. But then I just felt like the whole, that it wasn't as put together the pieces that he was finding out, discovering, as the first one. It was, all right, push through a doorway. Okay, now we see this, I guess, cult. I thought it was just, I don't know, it's just that disappointed me. He wasn't figuring things out. It wasn't a discovery, really. And it was like a huge buildup before we got any kind of pieces to the puzzle.
I can agree with that. I can see where that's coming from. There is a lot less discovery in Temple of Doom. It's more of a, it's kind of a horror film in some ways. I mean, I'm not going to call it a horror film, but it's sort of horror filmy in some ways. I think you'll enjoy Last Crusade
I'm very excited.
Yeah,
if absolutely.
If the discovery thing, you know, and him working his way through the puzzle is what got your attention the most, I think you're going to find a lot to love in Last Crusade. So I want to get an update on that whenever you get a chance to see that. So let's move on to our kind of our main event of this week. And this is sort of the heart of the show. So I have a very large film collection. And there are movies that I absolutely adore. And a lot of times when I try to show them to people, they fall asleep halfway through it, or they're just not interested, or there's something about it. Now, I know that Adam and I know that Ashley are big film people, but they've also maybe not seen a lot of these, you know, because we've gone through some films and it's like, no, I never saw it, never saw that. So the idea of this is I want to take a film from my little film basement, share it with you guys, and then I want to talk about it. And basically, you tell me if I'm wrong or not, you know. Now, I'm stacking the deck a little bit on week one. Like, I'll tell you right now, I'm going to fight to the death if anyone has an argument against the third man. But I want to know if this film is, you know, you watch this film for the first time. Like, Ashley, you just watched Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and you're like, God damn, this is phenomenal. So that shows that that movie works. No matter when it's released, that movie would work. And timelessness is a very hard thing to kind of capture. So this week, we're going to talk about Carol Reed's The Third Man. If you're unfamiliar with Carol Reed as director, I would also please check out Night Train to Munich, Odd Man Out, The Agony and the Ecstasy and Oliver. The screenplay was written by Graham Greene, who also wrote The Fallen Idol and The Quiet American. The music is probably one of the most standout elements of the film when it comes to like pieces of the puzzle. And the music is by Anton Karas, who actually, the way that that whole thing worked out was Karas met Carol Reed, the director, at a party in Vienna. And he was playing on this instrument, the zither. And that was it. They kind of started talking on that. He brought him back to London. He started, you know, having him play some music. And lo and behold, one of the most iconic movie sounds to open a film, you know, is kind of born. Cinematography is another thing in this film that is absolutely amazing. It's shot by Robert Krasker, who was also the cinematographer on Noel Coward's Brief Encounter, which was directed by David Lean, which also stars Trevor Howard, who plays Major Calloway in The Third Man. That is a film we are going to absolutely visit because we are going to do two films, A Brief Encounter, and then another film, much more modern film, back to back, and see if we can find any threads that connect with it. Krasker also shot Olivier's Henry V, which, speaking towards Brana, there's always a fun argument to be had about whether or not Henry V, his Henry V, or his Hamlet is the better of the, you know, his films. Always fun. Krasker also was the shot on Odd Man Out, The Quiet American, El Cid with Charlton Heston and Sophia Loren. Towards the cast, we have quite a hell of a cast, but obviously all eyes sort of go to the character of Harry Lime, who is Orson Welles. You know, if you don't know Orson Welles, Citizen Kane, Touch of Evil, F for Fake. If you've never seen a documentary, F for Fake, that's going to be a film we're going to touch on later in the future of the show. And of course, he was in the Muppet movie, so you have to mention the Muppet movie.
Oh, you forgot the most important one.
Transformers? Are you going to say fucking Transformers? You're going to say Transformers, aren't you? Yeah, he's Transformers. He's in that one, too. So Orson Welles, though, traditionally a massive pain in the ass. And this movie was no different. So he, you know, takes the role. They start shooting. He's like 2 weeks late. He is just a, you know, egotistical, with good reason, but, you know, very egotistical, very full of himself. He does inject probably the most famous line of dialogue in this film, one of the most famous lines of dialogue ever written.
Don't be so gloomy. After all, it's not that awful. What the fella said, in Italy for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace, and what did that produce? The cuckoo clock. So long, Holly.
But he doesn't even show up for some days, and to not lose time, during the whole escape through the sewers, some of that's not Orson Welles. Because they just gave up and they were like, we got to get a body. They used the body double, who was another guy on the crew. I forget who he was exactly. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, kind of crazy history with anyone who deals with Orson Welles, but this is one of the big ones, because then after this movie, he embraces Harry Lime, and he does a series of radio plays that focus on Harry Lime. So he was like just, again, a massive pain in the ass to work with, but in his head, he loved the role, and he just ran with it. So in the lead role of Holly Martins is Joseph Cotten. This was actually going to be Jimmy Stewart's role. That was who Carol Reed originally got, but issues with contracts of who's, you know, signed to work where, got Joseph Cotten in the role, who also was in Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, Shadow of a Doubt by Hitchcock, and The Magnificent Ambersons, also with Orson Welles, directed by him as well. Alida Valli plays Anna Schmidt, who did a lot more of, you know, Euro films, but in particular, Eyes Without a Face and Suspiria by Dario Argento, which is getting a remake, which is crazy talk. But hey, you never know. Trevor Howard plays Major Calloway, one of my favorite actors of all time. He was also in Gandhi. He was the first elder in Superman, the original, Dick Donner's Superman. Yes, I just said Dick Donner. I don't know why, because I keep reading articles where they refer to him as that. And it just sounds really cool. He was also in a aforementioned film, A Brief Encounter. Mutiny on the Bounty, also with Brando and Richard Harris. One other name of is a particular stature is Bernard Lee, who plays Sergeant Payne, the very large right-hand man to Major Calloway. You may know him best as M in the Bond franchise. He first appeared in Dr. No, and his last appearance as M was in Moonraker. So there we go. We have a hell of a cast. We have a film. We have the cinematography that's talked about. But hey, I put this in front of you, and I want to talk about it. So Ashley, the first thing I want to ask you about this is the music. The music is, you know, featured prominently throughout the film. It is overpowering in some sequences. It is also, for me, completely against the nature of some of what you're watching, because there's an upbeat feel to the zither guitar. But then you're watching the scenes of which it's playing out, and nothing is upbeat in this movie. You know, there's a couple of spots of comedy. What did you think about the whole inclusion and, you know, the zither on its own?
So the first watch through of it, this is the first time I've ever seen it. And I will admit that I did watch it about like 2.5 times after it, cause I wasn't wowed. So I'm like, I'm missing something. But the first time around, the music was a little jarring at certain points where it was kind of like soap opera, even like you turn to the screen and you're like, bum, bum, bum. And, where you're like, okay, be thrilled. Something thrilling's going to happen, or something, you know, just was revealed. Now you know. Then the second time through, I really enjoyed it, because there are touches of humor throughout the movie that I think really made it for me. And so adding that music in, it felt right the second time around. I don't know what the difference was, but... Maybe I just embraced it.
Maybe it was also just because now it wasn't like a surprise. Like, you already knew that was coming, so it's a little more easier to swallow in the second runaround.
Yeah.
I remember watching it the very first time, and there's a couple of times where I thought the music was so loud that I couldn't hear what was going on. I have a problem with that, though, in films a lot of times. Like, I have trouble hearing dialogue and loud sequences, so I didn't know if that was always just for me. Adam, you know, a couple other things I just want to, you know, ask you guys about specifically. The camera work in this film, and Ashley, I would love to hear you chime in on this too. The camera work is something of, you know, infamous nature in some senses, that it is heavy on the Dutch angles, which, you know, if you don't know what a Dutch angle is, it is a, you know, a crooked shot in so many ways. Like, to give it the best thing, it's giving an skewed view, to borrow the, you know, not Kevin Smith, but a skewed view of, you know, the action and the scenes. And there are very few shots in this film that are straight as an arrow. Most of them are angled on Dutch. And just to give you a little bit of a funny quote, a funny little story, William Wyler, who was a fellow director and friend of Carol Reed, once gave him a letter that said, "Carol, quote, Carol, next time you make a picture, just put this on top of the camera, will you?" And it was a little spirit level for him to know that it, actually, in fact, your camera is not straight. So what did you what about you? I love the use of the Dutch angles in this because everything is so goddamn messed up in this film. But did you find it distracting? Because this is another thing that Kenneth Branagh gets some shit for, to kind of tie up with what we were talking about before. He gets a lot of guff when he does stuff like this as well.
No, it did not distract me at all. It, in a lot of ways, the use of the Dutch angle gives it the identity of what we're experiencing throughout the film. If you can say, hey, what are some notable takeaways from The Third Man? Two things I'm going to say right away are the Dutch angles and the music. And they help give it its own identity, because there are plenty of films that are noir type crime movies, but you're like, oh, okay, they're shot, you know, standard, shooting fare. But this one, you're looking at it and it's weird. It kind of reminded me of like a pulp novel or a comic book in some ways of what I was seeing on the screen.
I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. Definitely. That works some way. So, you know, Ash, just, you know, go along. What did you, you know, tell me your whole impression, you know, just, you know, on the rest of the film, the performances, everything. Do you think that this film lives up to the reputation that it has?
All right, so I'll be honest. The first time through, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But I, you know, I will have to... I did read the article that Martin Scorsese wrote about it for The Independent, and I kind of agreed with his professor from NYU that said, remember, it's only a thriller, which was kind of how I felt the first time through. And then I'm like, oh, this is, you know, great acclaim. Everybody's talking so well about this movie. I must be missing something. So I watched it again, and I just kind of fell in love with it. There's just the attention to detail is, I think, what I love the most about it. Just these tiny details that you'll pick up on that set kind of the world that they're living in, Vienna now after the war, that you pick up on. Like, Anna has the liquor bottle given to her of whiskey, and she's like, oh, well, I wanted to sell it anyway. I'm glad, you know, you didn't want any. and the same with, I think, Holly offers Anna's elderly neighbor cigarettes, and she just takes a whole bunch of them. So, right away that, you know, a lot of products are sparse, and a lot of people are trying to make a buck off them, which they do say multiple times, but you get them in these little details that are actually funny too, like these touches of humor.
So then towards that, I mean, we see people kind of, you know, just offhandedly smuggling things, you know, between each other and all that. But then at the center point of our film is Harry Lime, who's smuggling is leading to the deaths of, you know, children and others. But obviously, you know, when Calloway wants to really make his point to Holly Martin's, you know, he brings him to the child hospital and all that kind of stuff. So the question that I've always taken away from this film is a question that Holly gets asked by Harry in that Prada wheel scene, which is one of the classic scenes of cinema all time. And he asks him, how many dots, you know, would you be okay with stopping, you know? Would you really tell me to keep my money? And I've always struggled with that answer to that, quite honestly, because, shit, man, money's hard to make, you know? Struggling is not fun. And, Adam, would you let a dot stop you from making $20,000 tax-free?
I don't know. It really depends on the situation. I'm not going to lie.
So, I mean, isn't that fascinating, though, that without really knowing Harry, we relate to him because of how much the people around him, like, love him, even though they like, slowly or even, like, blindly accept that he's a monster, you know? Some of them know it, and they don't care because they're monsters, too. But in particular, Anna and Holly. Why, you know, what is it about this guy, Ashley, you know, what is it about this guy that makes them just build excuses for him so much And even after, you know, being proven that Lyme is a scumbag, Anna especially is just ready to shun the world in order to keep that pride of Harry Lyme in her chest.
Right. Well, see, I struggled with Anna's character a lot because I'm like, I let it go, girl. Like, he's not doing anything for anyone, and he certainly doesn't care about you anymore. Didn't even bother to tell you he was going to fake his own death. And then Holly, you know, he lets it go a little bit more easily after he gets the evidence. But I guess it has to do with fun. You know, Anna, every time she talks about him or asks Holly about him, she's always like, what was he like? He's so much fun. He's still a child. You know, the world hasn't gotten to him. So maybe it's that they like that the world hasn't bogged Harry down. He's still got this, I guess, fun-loving attitude. We don't really know him because we've only heard about him and then get him in the second half of the movie, which he's running half the time. So
he's running a lot. That reveal, though, actually, and I want to say this might be from that exact article that you were citing before. This is Scorsese speaking about the reveal in The Third Man. Wells comes into the picture about halfway through. That's the first time you actually see him after you spent so much time picturing him in your mind because everyone has been talking about him and thinking about him. So that might be the best revelation or the best reveal, as they say, in all of cinema. When Harry is, end quote, when Harry is sitting in the doorway and the cat is pawing, which if you pay real close attention, they set up that moment when Holly goes into the room. And like, Ashley, this is kind of going towards you, like the little details that they put into building a scene as to what is going to happen next. That's the stuff I really love. So Holly comes in. He's really drunk. He's got the flowers for Anna. And the cat's there. And the cat doesn't, obviously, as cats do, doesn't give a shit about anyone. And Anna says, he always only liked Harry. And then the cat goes out the window. And so it's like, without that little piece of knowledge, that scene of all of a sudden this cat finding this one guy in the street, you know, who's hidden in the shadow, would seem very, what's the word I'm looking for? Fortunate, you know? But they do the work in the words to that justifies what you're then shown in the very next scene or the continuation of the scene going forward. So that's the little stuff that I've really enjoyed. Another thing I love about the film is the ending. And obviously, if you're listening to this, I'm assuming that you have watched The Third Man. If you haven't, listen, watch it right now and then come on back. Would either of you wanted to see a different ending than Anna walking right past Holly?
No, because it wouldn't be in character of her at this point. I mean, she's stuck by Harry Lyme so much and to a ridiculous extreme that if she actually would be like, yeah, okay, let's have a romantic kiss at the end, you'd be like, this girl has lost her mind. So
now what if I told you that obviously Carol Reed didn't want that ending, but there were people at the studio who wanted a happy ending, and he had to fight for it. He had to fight for that shot that she just walks by him. Adam, do you think it takes the piss out of the whole thing if they put a happy little bow on top of this for Holly Martins?
Absolutely. I read, after I watched the movie, I read about the alternate ending they had proposed, and the filmed ending was the absolute right way to go. I think the happy ending would have just, like you said, taken the piss out of it. I think it would have changed Anna more than I think that was a brave shot. She just walks right by him. He's sitting like, okay, I'm gonna make something happen, and then she's like, nothing.
And if I remember correctly, he doesn't even turn.
No, not at all. Yeah. She just ignores him like he's not even there.
He like lights his cigarette and enjoys it.
what a shit sandwich to eat at the end of all that. But ultimately, though, he does the right thing. It takes him forever to get there, but he does the right thing. And actually, I never got to really put the question towards you. And I know that like a lot of people will be like, oh, well, and this is the sexist thing of stupidity. Oh, she's a girl, so she wouldn't kill anyone for money, which I think is insane. Most women would kill somebody for money, which may be opposite sexist right there. What about you? I mean, during that Prada wheel scene, do you find any common ground with Harry Lime in his reasoning.
No, but it doesn't. It has nothing to do with me being a woman. It has everything to do with me just having this kind of morally righteous attitude about things. I don't know. I don't think, like, I'm very, oh, you can't just take a human life. What are you, you know, God, which, you know, I don't, you know, I'm kind of an atheist, but, you know, I don't, I just feel like it's not your place to decide, but at the same time, I'd be like, oh, well, kill Harry Lime, because he just killed a bunch of people and ruined a bunch of kids' lives. So, yeah, no, it has nothing to do with me being a woman. It just has to be. I'm very on the side of Holly Martin's here, where, like, do the right thing. You know, it could be a struggle because you love your friend, which, yeah, it would be a struggle if one of my friends was doing this and turning them in. But it's more just do the right thing. Don't let people get away with these things. Even, you know, Harry's comment about, oh, tax-free, and, you know, that's, like, the problem with corporations today, you know, that, you know, who cares about the little dot? You know, they don't think about people as people, so that's more just my own thing.
See, it's this line that always got me, because because Wells is so damn good in this, but this particular one, he's, you know, Ashley, as you were saying, no, tax-free, old man, tax-free. I love how he calls him old man. And Holly says, you used to believe in God. He says, oh, I still do
believe in God, old man. I believe in God and mercy and all that, but the dead are happier dead. They don't miss much here, poor devils.
And he's kind of right, though. Like, it doesn't look great living in Vienna right now. It kind of looks like it sucks. Like, you know, if you've got money and this and that, you're fine. But it kind of looks like a shit show, you know, beyond that really tight circle of people who got it going. And I heard that line and I'm like, yeah, it's probably accurate. Like, they're probably not really missing much. You know, like, if they're already, like, so screwed that, you know, they got to go everywhere to just try to live. It doesn't sound great. But, you know, and that's why I like that Holly hesitates. You know, I don't think that he would ever take him up on his offer. But, you know, he does.
It was the hospital scene that pushed him over, though.
It was, yeah.
It was. And I think that's kind of what the director and the writers were intending, that we're kind of like, okay, Harry, you're doing your thing, you know, no harm, no foul. And then we go to the hospital and we see the effects of the watered down, what was it, penicillin?
Penicillin, yeah.
Yeah, we're having on the children. They don't show the children. They just show
great
the
stuff.
Face. Yeah, that was a great shot.
Also, so much easier to shoot than having to get goddamn children.
Yeah.
Like, it's one of those moments where you're like, really smart on a number of fronts. Yeah. Like, there's not just one good reason. There's a number of good reasons to do that.
Yeah.
But exactly. I'm sorry, you were saying.
No, you don't
so, yeah.
even need that. You just need to see the teddy bears and
that's,
that kills
yeah,
you.
Yeah, right? The two shots of the teddy bears, I was like, oh. Yeah. Those like were, you know, they were crumbling. But remember, though, Martin's knows about the children. He hasn't seen it. But he knows that that's one of the main riffs of Harry's thing is stealing this penicillin, you know, and giving it out to children who are then sick. Like, Calloway tells him that, you know, right on Front Street. So he doesn't really, like, again, though, it's his admiration and his love and his feeling of ownment to, you know, to Harry Lime that holds him back. And then actually, what's even crazier about that is, though, when we do get the scene in the Prado wheel, we learn that Harry in the past has left Holly Martin's to take the blame. You know, we talk about, you know, breaking in on that gambling, you know, the gambling joint. And he's like, oh, you found a way out for yourself, you know. So this isn't, I mean, in the past, there's been times where Harry just leaves Holly out to dry. Why does Holly even think for a second? Well, actually, let me change the question. Do you think that Harry actually cares about anyone else but himself? Do you think he ever truly loved Anna? Do you think he actually really cares about Holly? Or was he just waiting to use Holly as a fall guy at a later date?
So I think not. I think he really does only care about himself. But then there is this small detail where he's popping the the pills to stop his stomach aches.
Yeah, the antacid. The antacid.
Yeah, the antacid. Sorry, I just couldn't think of the word for it. but I think that it's trying to signal to us that maybe there is some kind of human being in him that, or maybe it's just the running. Maybe it's the running and the faking his own death that's causing his stomach to be upset. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
But maybe that is trying to point to us that, okay, he cares a little bit because something's actually causing his stomach to be upset constantly.
That's a good, I've never thought of that. I never looked at it that way. That's an interesting point. Is he doing that because he's actually gaining some sort of a conscious, like even, you know, subconsciously? You know, if he's not realizing it, but this is sort of taking a toll on him, or is it just the stress of being on the run? It's probably that, the stress of being on the run, but there's also that, you know, that final moment between Holly and Harry where after Sergeant Payne is, you know, is shot, I almost said Major Payne, that would have been, whoops, you know, after he gets shot and killed by Harry, Holly has no hesitation in picking up that gun, going over there, but there's still the moment where he looks at Harry, Harry looks at him, and Harry nods as if to say, like, you know, do you think that there's some solace for Holly and Harry that it was Holly who shoots him, Adam, do you think?
Yeah, I think if he had to go down, it had to be Holly to do it, and I think that being the character that Harry is, I think he preferred it. And I think that's how he could go out on his own terms. And he knew it was the end. And what better than the person that you wanted to be part of your life. And I think that was the way he wanted to go.
All right. Well, how about, you know, just Ashley, do you have any other, you know, just thoughts that you want to shoot out there about the film as in its overall form? You know, what was there anything that didn't work for you even after, you know, your repeated viewing that you then fell for? Was there anything that didn't work for you? What were some of your, you know, your higher points of the film as well? Like what sticks to your, you know, what sticks in your head about the film?
Let's see. Well, so I know how you mentioned, for the Murder on the Orient Express, you thought that the person who actually, I guess, did the murder, I don't know, I haven't seen the Orient Express, that it wasn't enough clues to give you that final reveal. Mm-hmm. And on the first go through, I thought the, like Joseph Haben, who ended up being the guy killed to put in Harry's grave.
Yes.
I was like, oh, okay, cool. So we just find out all about Joseph, but that he's another player in this mystery too late on. But on the second viewing, the Major Calloway asks Anna about him, but you have to have a very, I think, good ear to pick up on, do you know who Joseph Haben is? He asks her somewhere along those lines. So for me, the reveal is great. And I was also like, well, now that we have the reveal that Harry's not in that grave, what are they going to do with the rest of the movie? Which was interesting. But so that was one problem I had in the first viewing, which it reconciled with watching it again and paying closer attention to what they were saying and all the details.
Mm-hmm.
The high points, I guess I already stated that they were great with these tiny details. And there was a lot of the theme of death just kept coming up, which was, you know, like Harry says, you know, they're better off dead. And Anna has said that she's, you know, she wishes, I struggle. Now, Anna is whatever.
Always
potato, potato, off, right?
Yeah.
you know, she's like, oh, I wish I were dead. And, you know, Major Calloway even says to Holly, you're born to be murdered. It's a huge, huge theme that most people seem like they didn't really want to be alive in this film by the way that they said things sometimes.
So maybe he had it right.
Yeah.
Adam, how about you? You have any final thoughts you want to throw out there about The Third Man?
I do. You've seen this a couple times, I'm assuming.
Yeah, a couple, two, three times, yeah.
I saw this two times. I saw it the first time last week, and then I watched it again. I drew, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are, a lot of comparison between Harry Lime and Walter White from Breaking Bad.
Yes.
There's a lot of third man in Breaking Bad, and almost to the final scenes. I don't know. I took a lot of that. I'm wondering if Vince Gilligan had a knowing influence from the third man and just incorporated that in.
I mean, the advantage of Breaking Bad is that we see Walter White before. Yeah. And then we see the transformation into, you know, the Heisenberg, you know, personality and all that and everything that comes there for after. So I believe that some of the radio plays are actually pre-Third Man, Harry Lime, where you learn a little bit about the man before he turned into the Rocketeer.
Yeah, it would kind of have to be pre-Third Man.
Yeah, yeah. But what I'm saying is, like, I'm saying it may even predate before he was doing the penicillin racket.
Okay.
Even before that. And I believe it builds him up to be more of an anti-hero who just falls. And so I can definitely see that. And yeah, there are some nods. And the only thing that I would say is Harry threatens you with a smile, you know, or a blank stare, where Walter White will threaten you with, fear. You know, with actual anger and, you know, real purpose of, like, violence will come upon you. You know, even because, again, we can go to the Prada Wheel scene where he just opens the door casually, you know, and then he's like, don't think they'd look for a bullet wound for you if you hit that ground. You know, and it's like, Jesus, you would shoot him and then throw him off the goddamn wheel? Like, that's a really shitty thing to do. But he does it in a charming way. Like, he's the charming Walter White, whereas Walter White was the more – he intimidated you with power, where Harry doesn't seem to have to – he doesn't feel the need to do that. He can do it with a smile. But I do think that your point is still accurate. I think that there are a lot of parallels to be drawn. And I think that if we knew more about the radio show, there would probably be even more parallels to draw from there, and, you know, and going out of that. And I mean, are we saying that Holly is, I mean, Holly's definitely not a Jesse, because Jesse is, you know, he's, you know, part of the whole thing, but, you know, the people who are around him, they seem to care about him, but they don't understand why anymore. So there's right. That also can be like part of the Walter White thing. I can see that. There's probably a deeper rabbit hole to go in on that, actually.
Yeah.
So definitely. Yeah. So, I mean, ultimately the question is, does this film belong in the film basement, Ashley? Yes or no?
Yes.
What do you think, Adam? You agreed? Is this a film that deserves its stature in the film basement?
Certainly. It's an amazing film. I was pretty blown away.
Stature earned. It stays. Nothing. If you guys don't agree, I have to burn my copy of the film. I will not do that. but that's it, guys. That's our show for this week. Next week, we are going to actually go over to another older film known for its use of shadows. I thought it would be a good tale to follow after we see the incredible. Let's just talk for just a brief moment. The cinematography in The Third Man is incredible. They would wet down the streets of Vienna, which was all shot on location, mind you, tax-free. And they would wet down the streets of Vienna so you have that beautiful reflection coming off the cobblestone streets and all the rubble because we are coming off the heels of World War II. So, hey, man, if you ever want a production value, Jesus, really couldn't have asked for something worse to have made your scene look so good as World War II was. We are going to watch Night of the Hunter next week. An absolute thriller of a flick, extremely well known for its cinematography and for the menace that Robert Mitchum creates and through history would be mimicked and doubled over. So that will be next week's show. And we will talk about, God help us all, JLA We will see it, and we will talk about that at the top of the show next week. So thank you so much for joining us. Adam, Ashley, thank you so much for taking time out of your night for making the Film Basement, you know, whole again. So thank you both very much. Good night, guys.
Anytime.
Yeah.
Good night. Thank you for having us.
Later, everybody.
Reach the wizard. Reach the wizard.